Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at thomisticinstitute.org.
Well, thanks very much for having me, and thanks for coming out. And I'm especially, I have to say, I'm impressed that you guys have these events on Saturday. Like, I mean, most people use Saturday to chill out or catch up, and you guys are like taking a step forward. I don't know, I'm impressed. Okay, so the talk is called Does God Exist? This is just the outline. So if you're starting to feel desperate, and you can tell like how far through you are, how soon
the agony will be over.
Okay, so does God exist? I hope you won't be disappointed if I say that that's a question that can't be settled adequately in a short talk. I hope none, but what I'll do is less ambitious, but I hope helpful nonetheless. I'll explore the possibilities and limits for using philosophy to learn about God's existence. Now, since this is organized by the Thomistic Institute, you won't be surprised to hear that I'll be presenting things in a way that jives with the approach of Thomas Aquinas. But I won't be doing it because I was brought in by the Thomistic Institute. Instead, I'll be doing it because I think it makes good sense. So here's the order. I'll be presenting things in here. That's what's on the board. First, I'll give a brief sense of what philosophy is in the first place. And second, I'll give brief discussions of reasons for believing in God other than as a result of philosophical argumentation. Third, I'll discuss the idea of believing in God on the basis of philosophical argumentation. That's going to be the main part of the talk. Fourth, I'll consider the following question. If we have used philosophy to provide philosophical reasons for believing in God, what comes next, philosophically speaking? Fifth, I'll briefly look at objections to the idea that there exists a God. And sixth, I'll point out limitations of philosophy when it comes to talking about God. Okay, so here's a quick account of what philosophy is. It's the use of reason, unaided by divine revelation, to investigate the most foundational questions. So, when I say unaided by divine revelation, I mean that philosophy doesn't rely on the Bible or any other possible revelation from God. Instead, it just tries to figure things out by human reasoning alone. Now, what I mean by saying the most foundational questions can be explained as follows. If I ask you what is the past tense of jump, you will tell me it's jumped. If I ask you, why is it jumped and not jam? I mean, that's a pretty good question, actually. Right? We see run, ran, swim, swam. So why not jump, jamp? Well, the answer has something to do with the two types of verbs in English, strong verbs and weak verbs. Okay. If I ask you what a verb is, you might say something about action. People tell you verbs are action words, but then like is a verb. You say the house is red, but I don't think that's an action. It's like being red an action. I don't think so. I mean, what is a verb? It's not so clear, is it? So if I ask you what words are, then you might say, well, they're sounds that or something like this. Okay, so as we go through this, is it jump or jam? What are the different kinds of verbs? What's a verb anyway? What's a word? If we go through this, the questions are getting deeper, you might say. They're getting more basic. They're getting more foundational. If you're in a conversation like this, at some point somebody goes, whoa, it's getting really philosophical. And that's exactly right. The deeper or more foundational a question is, the more quote-unquote philosophical it is. And probably there's no precise line between questions that are philosophical and questions that are not, but almost. So anyway, if you get as far as asking whether there's a God, then clearly you're in philosophy territory. So the question is whether we can know that there is a God and whether we can know that solely on the basis of natural human reasoning powers, if we can know it philosophically. Okay, so that's part one. So number two, the purpose of this talk is to think about how we might come to believe in God on the basis of philosophical argumentation, but partly for the sake of completeness and partly for the sake of contrast, I want to indicate some of the ways we might come to believe in God other than by philosophical argumentation. The fact that they aren't the same as philosophical argumentation doesn't automatically make them bad. They have their strengths and their weaknesses. I'm not going to say much about that here. I'm just going to mostly talk about what they are. So one way we might come to believe in God, non-philosophically, would be by accepting the idea that there's a God on the basis of human authority. The authority of our parents, for example, or on the basis of the fact that nearly all human beings have, in some way, believed in God. So relying on the authority of other people is not always wrong. Sometimes there's just no alternative. Still, from the philosophical standpoint, it's a kind of a weak sort of support. Another way we might come to believe in God, again, non-philosophically, would be on the basis of experience of God. Somehow, in some way, you or I have had an encounter with God, and thereby come to know that God exists, even maybe something about what God is like. The question of whether we can experience God is a rather complicated one. If God is what Christians say, then we can't experience God by means of any of our natural powers, because God is so different that he transcends our natural powers. So, like, think of ultraviolet radiation, right? It's there, but it falls outside the range of what human vision can see. Or think of the Earth's magnetic field. Apparently, turtles can sense this, but we can't. Well, God is outside of what we can experience, but in a much more radical way. So if people can experience God, it might be because God himself had intervened to make that possible. We can't just spot God. He has to make his presence available to us. Now, whether this can happen and what to make of it when it does is an important question, but it falls outside the topic of this lecture. We can obviously reflect philosophically on the possibility of experiencing God. That's what we're doing right this very second. And we can reflect on what those experiences might mean, but all that would be reflecting on something that happened sort of outside the bounds of what philosophy deals with. So there's a way in which it wouldn't really be philosophy in the sense that I mentioned earlier. A third way we might come to believe in God would be through divine faith. Now, by this I mean accepting something on God's own authority. God reveals something, and therefore we accept it, and we're moved to do so by God's own operation on our mind and will. God teaches us something, and he also moves us to accept his teaching on his authority, rather than because we can conclusively see it for ourselves. So faith, in this sense, is the starting point for a different field, not philosophy, but theology, which is often defined as faith-seeking understanding. We accept things on faith, and then we go on to reflect on them in the hope of understanding them better. The idea that there could be faith in this sense seems far from crazy. And if there is faith in this sense, then obviously it would be a great thing to have it. What more reliable starting point could there be than revelation from God? But I'm not going to really say a whole lot more about that in this talk, because accepting things on divine faith is not part of a philosophical method of inquiry. So now I want to get to the main portion of the talk. I want to address the question of believing in God's existence on the basis of philosophical argument or philosophical reasoning. Can we come to believe in God without relying on divine revelation or any other authority, without having any spiritual or mystical experiences, but simply on the basis of philosophical reasoning? One approach, one way to try this, would be to start with a definition or conception of God, and then come to realize that God just is the sort of thing that has to exist, that it would be self-contradictory to suppose that God doesn't exist. To put the argument in a very crude form, think of it like this. If the word God means a perfect being, then obviously God must exist, because otherwise he wouldn't be perfect, in which case he wouldn't be God. Now, this is not a very sophisticated version of the argument. There are much more sophisticated versions available. Thomas Aquinas, you'll be interested to hear, thinks that even in their best versions, these arguments don't work. His approach is totally different. For one thing, he doesn't start from a definition of God at all. Aquinas thinks, actually, that we can't really get an adequate definition of God. A real definition gives you the essence of something, and God is so different and so far above, so transcendent, that we can't have a definition of God. So instead of reasoning from definition to existence, Aquinas reasons from effect to cause. Now, of course, we reason from effect to cause all the time. If your window breaks, you reason that something must have struck your window, maybe a baseball. The window breaking is the effect, and the baseball hitting it is the cause. Well, Aquinas uses roughly this sort of reasoning to arrive at the existence, not of baseballs, but of God. He actually offers a number of different arguments in a number of different works, but all, or anyway, most of them, fit this general structure of reasoning from effect to cause. Here's an example of that kind of argument. The world exists, so therefore the maker of the world exists, and that's God. Is this a good argument? No, it's not a good argument. It's a bad argument, but why is it a bad argument? You might say it's a bad argument because we can't reason from effects to causes in the first place. That's a super radical reason for objecting to the argument. Such an objection blocks not only arguments from the world to God, but also arguments from broken windows to baseballs. An objection like this undercuts not just arguments about God, but almost all the reasoning found in science, engineering, and everyday life. I'm not going to get into that sort of radical skepticism here. I'm going to take for granted that we can reason from effects to causes. But the mere fact that we can reason from effects to causes doesn't mean that there's no difficulty in arguing for God's existence. There's a special problem that needs to be dealt with. The problem is that when you reason from effect to cause in the ordinary way, you arrive at a conclusion like this. There's a cause, and it's the sort of thing that could produce the effect that we started from. So, for example, if something breaks your window, you can infer that it had enough kinetic energy to break your window. But you can't infer more than that. And you especially can't infer that what broke your window had infinite power. Perhaps you can see how this applies to arguments for the existence of God. The argument, as given earlier, went like this. The world exists, therefore the world maker exists. Now, in order to make the world, a world maker would have to be pretty impressive. It would have to be very intelligent and very powerful. But we're supposed to be arguing for the existence of God. We're supposed to be arguing for the existence of something that is infinitely intelligent and infinitely powerful. Our world is finite. So the fact that a world maker made it doesn't prove that the world maker is infinite. But that means that we haven't proved that our world maker is God. Not really. What's more, how do we know that the world maker doesn't have a world maker of its own? Little kids ask this question all the time, right? They say, yeah, but who made God? If there's a world maker, why isn't there a world maker maker? This question is important because if there's a world maker maker, then the world maker isn't really God. Also, there's probably a world maker maker maker. Did I say it right?
I think so.
Yeah. Okay, so we've been looking at the argument that goes, there's a world, therefore there's a world maker, and that's God. You've probably guessed by now that Aquinas' argument doesn't go like that. Aquinas, when I say Aquinas' argument, he has a bunch of arguments, but a lot of them fit a certain style. They are indeed arguments from effect to cause, but they don't merely say that where there's an effect, there must be a cause. They argue that where there are effects and causes, there must ultimately be an ultimate cause. Not just a cause, but an uncaused cause. And this, for Aquinas, is a good way to arrive at the existence of God. So how do you argue for an uncaused cause? Roughly, very roughly, you argue like this. Things around us have causes. A, let's say, is caused by B. To put it the other way, B is the cause of A. Now, B might itself have a cause, C. If so, then B isn't just a cause of A. It's a caused cause of A. Things around us have causes. A, let's say, is caused by B. Or to put it the other way around, B is the cause of A. So that arrow means that thing at the foot of the arrow is the cause, and the thing at the arrowhead, the part of the arrow, is the effect. Now, B might itself have a cause, C. If so, then B isn't just a cause of A. It's a caused cause of A. Right? It's a cause, but it's a cause. Now, of course, C, B's cause, might in turn have its own cause, D, in which case, C would itself be a caused cause. And we can extend this, right? D might be caused by E, E might be caused by F. But here's the thought. You can't go back like this forever. At some point, you have to reach an uncaused cause. Now, the crux of it is the claim that it can't go on forever. Why can't it? Why can't we have an effect that comes from a cause, that comes from a cause, backwards forever? The reason is that caused causes depend on their causes. And it's not possible for everything that exists to be dependent. Ultimately, there has to be something independent. Without something independent, there literally wouldn't be anything at all. So that's the basic insight. Let me provide some images to make this more concrete. First, think of light shining from a mirror. Well, mirrors don't just shine all by themselves. They only reflect light that is shined on them. In short, they need to be illuminated. Now, a mirror can reflect light that comes from another mirror. This happens all the time, actually. But it can't go on like that forever. If it's just mirrors all the way back, you're going to have nothing but darkness. You need something that doesn't just reflect light, but that emits it as a source. At some point, you need a light bulb or a sun or something like that. You need an unilluminated illuminator, an unshined on shiner. Second, think of a boxcar in motion. Boxcars don't just move. They need to be pulled. A boxcar can, of course, be pulled by another boxcar. Happens all the time. But it can't go on like this forever. It can't be boxcars all the way down the line. At some point, you need a locomotive. You need an unpulled puller. Okay. So it's okay for a cause to be dependent. It's okay for a cause to be caused. But it's not okay for every cause to be dependent. Think of it this way. Suppose we agree that I'm going to buy your laptop. And I say, I'd like you to hand it over right now, and I'll give you $500 tomorrow. So maybe a bit suspicious, you say, show me the $500. And I say, well, I don't have it right now, but I'll be borrowing it from my brother. Okay, so now you ask my brother, I would like to see the $500. Well, he doesn't have it right now, but he'll be borrowing it from his poker buddy. It's okay if it goes back like this for five more steps, or even 500 more steps, but at some point, somebody has got to actually have the $500. Not everybody can be borrowing. It's okay to borrow from someone who is himself borrowing, but somewhere down the line, there has to be a lender who isn't himself a borrower. There has to be a source that doesn't itself receive from some prior source. Now, the guy with the 500, I mean the guy who actually has it in his hands, he is different from all the other guys. The other guys, even if they are lenders, are also borrowers. But the guy with the money is a non-borrowing lender. He's a creditor who isn't debtor. He actually owns the money. He's like a light bulb rather than a mirror. He's like a locomotive rather than a boxcar. So the series, the backward series, ends in something very different from all the other things in the series. Now, we've been exploring analogies or images that were meant to help us think about the difference between caused and uncaused causes. But they are only analogies. Light bulbs, locomotives, and guys with $500 are uncaused relative to mirrors, boxcars, and borrowers, but in truth, they too are caused causes. A truly uncaused cause would be far more different than other things. So if you get to something that's an uncaused cause, and not just uncaused in terms of having money or uncaused in terms of having light, but something that's uncaused all the way in every respect, that is going to be something that's a very, very different from anything else that is part of our ordinary experience. And that's what opens up the possibility that what the argument ends with is God. The argument ends not just with a cause and not just with an uncaused cause, relatively speaking, but with what is, absolutely speaking, a truly uncaused cause. And Aquinas says, this everybody calls God. Now, just to be clear, let me say, I have not given a full-blown version of any of Aquinas' arguments for God. What I've done is sort of gestured at some of them. There isn't time here to go into all the details, but what I've said does, I hope, give some sense of the general structure and strategy that Aquinas employs. Now, I have said that Aquinas ends his arguments by saying, and this everyone calls God. And you might think, you know, that's a little too fast. An uncaused cause is admittedly much more than just a world maker. For example, since it's uncaused, we already have an answer to the question, who made it? Namely, if you ask that question, it shows that you didn't understand. It's uncaused, so nothing made it. But still, maybe we aren't yet in a good position to use the G word. The mere fact that something is an uncaused cause might not be enough to make it correct to call it God. So that leads us to the next section of this talk, number 4, if you're keeping score. Suppose you have spent, I don't know, months and years reading and thinking and talking, and you conclude that some version of an argument like this actually works. Some of them, it turned out, didn't work, but some version of it does work. Maybe that's because you think that Aquinas' arguments work in the very form in which he gave them. Maybe you think they work in an improved form. Maybe you think that his arguments actually are just massively flawed, but some other arguments that are similar to them in certain respects work. Anyway, what next? Before answering that, let me mention that if Aquinas' arguments turned out to be bad arguments, he would not be angry at you for pointing this out. On the contrary, he would thank you. For one thing, he holds that if someone gives a bad argument for God, we should not act as if everything's okay, because at least they're on the right team. In fact, he says, we should shoot the argument down, because we don't want people thinking that belief in God is based on this bad argument. For another thing, Aquinas would thank you because you would have helped him get closer to the truth. And this is the really great thing about being in error. As soon as you admit that you're in error, you're not in error anymore. You know, they say that when you have a problem, the first step is to admit you have a problem. Okay. The amazing thing about the problem of being wrong is that as soon as you admit, the first step is also the last step. As soon as you admit that you're wrong, you don't think that anymore. So the instant you realize, whoops, I was wrong, boom, you're not wrong anymore. The pain is over instantly. I mean, you may not know what's right, so it's still annoying because you don't know, but at least you're not wrong anymore. So I'm just saying this because a lot of times we don't like to admit that we're wrong, but the thing is, as soon as you admit that you're wrong, you're not wrong. So it's okay. Okay. Anyway, as I say, Aquinas, he would be like, oh, thank you. Now, suppose you have found a good argument, okay, that arrives at the existence of an uncaused cause, an unreceiving source, something like that. Well, what comes next, philosophically speaking? The short answer is you just got to keep thinking. I mean, that's probably good advice in general, although not always. But it has a special meaning here. If you think that you have proved the existence of God, you still will not have proved everything that you might want to prove about God. You don't want to get carried away with what you've proven. It's tempting to think things like this. Hooray, there is an uncaused cause of change. God exists. His son Jesus is my personal savior. The Catholic Church is here to provide me with the fullness of the means of salvation. Now, you've gone way, way, way too fast here, right? If you think about it, all that stuff, like, all you've proved really is uncaused cause. Like, that's all you got at this point. So when Aquinas says everybody calls this God, he's not claiming at that stage to have more than uncaused cause. That's all he's proved so far. Now, you might say, okay, look, actually, Thomas Aquinas, he's fine. But he should not be using the word God there. That's fine, actually. This is not a really deep issue. But that should make you want to go even farther. You say, wow, there's an uncaused cause. Interesting. I wonder what it's like. Let's think about it more. Maybe it's so amazing that it would be worth calling it God. So proofs only prove so much. There's an awful lot that they don't prove. By the time he's finished giving proofs for God, Aquinas hasn't explicitly proved that this uncaused cause brought everything into being out of nothing. He hasn't proved that this uncaused cause loves us. Some of his arguments leave open the possibility that God doesn't even know we exist. For all we know at this point, this God thing is just some kind of force. Now, of course, Aquinas does think that God has a mind and that he knows about us and he created us and he loves us. He does think all of that, but he thinks it only because of further philosophical reasoning that he engages in. Each point requires its own reasoning. And in fact, it takes Aquinas 50 pages of highly compressed technical writing in small print to arrive at the conclusion that there's only one God. If you know the Summa Theologiae, that comes in question 11. So you think the whole time, of course, there's only one God, but
actually, it takes a lot of proving.
All right. So how does Aquinas take all of those extra steps? Well, the only way to answer that would be by going through those. And it would take all night. But I do want to make one important point. To a significant extent, the further reasoning that Aquinas goes through is the unfolding of the idea that he arrived at in the initial argument. What the arguments have in common is that God is where the buck stops. He's not just a cause, he's an uncaused cause. He gives, but what he gives, he didn't receive from somewhere else. He didn't receive it from anywhere else because just by his very nature, he already had it. He's completely perfect. So from that insight, Aquinas is able to go on and argue for lots of things about God. If he's perfect, he needs to have a mind, for example. So while it's true, as I said earlier, that Aquinas' arguments don't really give us a well-developed idea of a personal God, they do contain the seeds of that idea, and Aquinas gets those seeds to grow by further reflection. Okay. Now I want to say a brief word about objections to the idea that God exists. For Aquinas, as for most medieval philosophers and theologians, it's standard operating procedure not just to state your views and not just to give arguments for your views, but also to state objections to your views and answer those objections. Those of you who have read medieval philosophy know that like they even structure their works this way. They say, here's a list of objections to my view. I mean, just imagine if politicians did that. Like, what a different world this would be. Okay, well, anyway. So Aquinas lists two objections to God's existence, and they're probably the two most important objections. The first one is that there's evil in the world, and that that's enough to prove that there can't be any God. The second objection is that we don't need to believe in God, because we already have good enough explanations of everything. In a way, Aquinas' answer to the second objection is already lurking in his arguments in favor of God. Aquinas thinks it's false that we can give ultimate explanations of everything without appealing to God. Now, of course, and he's happy to admit this, we can give explanations of things without talking about God. Right? We can talk about what they're causing. But we can't give ultimate explanations. Because when we give explanations, we're appealing to things that themselves need explanations. So we've given an explanation, but not a final explanation, not an ultimate explanation. And that's where God comes in. Now, as for the first objection, Aquinas' answer goes well beyond anything contained in his arguments for God's existence. What he says in the particular text that I'm concerned with is short but deep. Someone who thinks that evil is an objection to God apparently thinks that the only proper way for God to deal with evil would be for God to destroy it. But Aquinas thinks that there's another alternative. God can allow evil to exist, but then draw a greater good out of it. There's a lot packed into that thought, but at the very least, it shows that the topic of God and evil is more complicated than it might initially appear to be. It is indeed a mysterious idea that God might allow evil rather than just snuff it out. But it seems far too quick to say that the existence of evil just flat out disproves God's existence. Aquinas' way of doing philosophy can get you some pretty substantial results. It can get you to the idea that God is good, that he's an immaterial spirit, that he's all-powerful, that he knows everything, that he created everything, that he guides everything, and so on. It might even get you to the idea that you should love and reverence God and pray to him. However, it has to be admitted, it would still be a pretty cold and abstract and philosophical kind of religion. No burning bush, no crossing the Red Sea, no return from captivity in Babylon, no Jesus dying on the cross for our sins, no sending of the apostles. A philosophical approach won't get you any of that stuff. It won't get you what most people would call a religion. It would be a philosophical religion, but not like a religion. Now, for Aquinas, you're not going to get a religion unless you go beyond philosophy. And the best way to do that is by accepting God's revelation. Revelation goes beyond human reason. It tells us things we could never prove on our own, and it gives us utter confidence about things that would otherwise just be based on our own potentially flawed philosophical reasoning. Now, it might be objected that relying on revelation is acting like a weakling. Shouldn't we do things under our own power? And to that, I think Aquinas would give two answers. First, if God is really God, then he's so far above us that it's ludicrous to think that we could have a good understanding of him just on the basis of our own power. It's just kind of delusional. Second, humans are weak and flawed. And, you know, I have to say, if Aquinas thinks that, then that really counts for something, because very few human beings have been as smart and hardworking as Thomas Aquinas. So, you know, maybe humans are pretty limited, in which case it would make sense for them to rely on divine help if they can get it. In any case, whether you accept the possibility of divine help or not, it's worthwhile being aware not only of the strengths of philosophical reasoning, but also of their limitation. Anything else would be like unphilosophical. Okay, so I'm going to conclude with a few concluding remarks. As you can tell from what's been said, Aquinas thinks that philosophical reason has a lot of power to figure stuff out about the existence and nature of God. At the same time, he thinks that philosophical reasoning has serious limits. Some of those limits are practical. Philosophy takes a lot of time. Often people are too busy. And even if you can spend a lot of time on it, you're still probably going to make a lot of mistakes. Some of those limits are not just practical, they're limits in principle. God so transcends the human mind that many important truths about God simply cannot be discovered by humans without divine revelation. So it's important to see both the power and the limits of philosophical reason. If all we see are the limits, then we'll think that there can't really be any dialogue between Christian believers and non-believers. Religion would be exclusively based on faith, and those who aren't believers would seem to have no access to God in any way until they had accepted divine revelation. There's another problem if philosophy has nothing to say about God. Of course, divine revelation is adequate, but it might not always be adequate for us. Revelation is hard to understand. Sometimes the Bible makes you think that God is an immaterial spirit. I mean, it says that. And then you turn the page and you read something about God's holy arm, not to mention his footstool. Philosophical reason can help us come up with intellectually solid and rigorous interpretations of Scripture, which sometimes uses a lot of figurative and metaphorical language. Again, the point isn't that the Bible needs philosophy, but that philosophy helps us understand the Bible. Cardinal Ratzinger, later Pope Benedict XVI, said once that it wasn't a coincidence, but divine providence, that the Son of God became human at a time and a place
when philosophy had already made enough progress that people could understand what had happened. That's an amazingly bold thing that he said.
Okay, so having praised philosophy, both for its ability to give us access to God without revelation and for its ability to help us understand revelation, let me now end with a reminder, once again, it has its limits. St. Augustine compared the philosopher without faith to a traveler who's on the top of a hill and who can, from there, catch a glimpse of where he needs to go. But he can't figure out how to get there. Only through revelation as a guide can we actually find the right path. So I think Aquinas would say this: philosophy is important, but it's not enough to tell you everything you need to know, and especially not the most important things you need to know. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.